We have as our MC the golden eagle of British comedy, the one, the only, the great Barry Cryer.
Oh, I'll stand up this time. I'm fractured my femur, as you know. Anyway, joined the hip-hop club. And this is not only a great pleasure to be here today, but it's rather inconvenient. It's our great-granddaughter's birthday, Isabel. Yes, she's two. I said, take that thing out of your mouth, Isabel. You have to blow the candles out. Remember the my birthday the last time, the candles cost more than the cake. Two people fainted from the heat. Anyway, I've warned our authors, you regulars know, there is a ritual, a convention, prior to introducing them, the parrot joke. And as I always say, if you feel tempted to join in, please don't. It spoils it for the few who haven't heard it. When we went in the shop, she saw the beautiful blue and gold parrot, and she said, he's gorgeous, how much? She said, 20 quid, 20 pounds. I said, 20 pounds? He's beautiful. He said, well, I've got to be honest with you, he's got form, he's got history. He was in a brothel, and to put it delicately, he's got quite an extensive vocabulary. She said, 20 pounds, I'll take a chance on that. And she bought the parrot and took it back to her flat. And she took the cover off, and the parrot looked round and said, new place, very nice. And her two daughters walked in, and the parrot said, new place, new girls, very nice indeed. And her husband walked in, and the parrot said, hello, Keith. Now, enough. We have two Simons here today. It's a game of doubles and two Simons. And here we go, Simon. Our author's book concerns the First World War, a vivid analysis which sets before us the politics and the revolutionary changes that occupied, over which his graphic narrative ranges. His title is Staring at God, a transfixing thought. And enough. I stop before you. All are caught in my wandering web and grow deaf and deafer. Will you welcome our author, Simon Heffer?
Barry, thank you very much to you for that warm welcome. And thank you for asking me today. Thank you for coming. And it's a great joy for me to be here as Simon Jenkins' warm-up man, which is something I've been longing to do throughout my career. I'm hoist with my own petard because I've got exactly 10 minutes, I'm informed, to sum up a book of 827 pages, plus footnotes, plus index. And the footnotes are very interesting, let me assure you of that. I was asking before we came into this magnificent lunch how long I had, and I was reminded of a dinner I went to about 20 years ago, which one or two of you may have had the misfortune to be present. It was a grand American corporation that hosted General Colin Powell, who was then one of the most famous men in the world, and he'd just published his autobiography. And he got up at 9:30 to entertain us about this, and when I left, it was 11:15, and he'd got to about the age of 20. It was then, if never at any other time, I learned the benefits of concision. The book I have written is the third volume of what will be four volumes of a history of what I regard as the most, and to use a ghastly vogue word, transformative century in the history of our country, which is from 1838 to 1939. You can argue that the Battle of Hastings was quite important. You can argue that the Reformation was quite important. But I don't think that our country ever changed quite so much, quite so profoundly, and experienced such ups and downs as we did in those 101 years. And this volume, although it's, I'm afraid, a very long book, just covers five of those years, exactly 5 years, from the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo on the 28th of June, 1914, and finishes with the signing of the Treaty of Versailles in the Salle des Glaces at Versailles on the 28th of June, 1919. And it's not a military history. Those are the first six words in the book. It's a story of how people at home coped. There's endless books on the home front in the Second World War, and hardly any have been written at all on the First World War. One very good book came out about 25 years ago by my friend Jerry de Groot, who's a professor of history at St Andrews University, called Blighty. And he was only allowed about 400 pages. My publisher was far more gullible. And in it, he managed to give a very clear picture of this country. Jerry reviewed my book in the Times last month, and his only criticism, I'm glad to say, was that it wasn't as entertaining as the last one. And I dropped him a line saying, if you can tell me how 888,000 British Empire dead can be entertaining, I'd love to hear it. Because unfortunately, that is the story of the war. Lots of young men who'd grown up never imagining they were going to go and fight in a war went and did so. And 888,000 of them from this country and from the British Empire formed what was known in 1919 as the Unreturning Army. And this had the most incredible knock-on effect on their widows, their children, their mothers. It changed the face of society, and this is what this book is about. There's a lot in this book about women, because by nature, all the young men who were fit were on the Western Front or in the Middle East, and the country was handed over, really, to women to run. They become this army of munitionettes, as Lloyd George called them, who went into munitions factories, sometimes suffered great injuries and death when these factories decided from time to time to blow up. And they ensured that our army on the Western Front was properly supplied with munitions. The Women's Land Army, which everybody thinks was formed in the Second World War, was actually formed in the First World War by a very enterprising woman called Dame Muriel Talbot, who ensured that women were drafted in from parts of the country where there wasn't much agriculture to parts where there was quite a lot of it, and they were sent onto the land. You find endless stories of farmers in 1915 and 16 saying, I'm not having women on my farm because they can't do the heavy jobs that men do. By 1917, when there are no men there to do those jobs, they're all being done by women, and you know what, being done remarkably well. The only people who seem to fail in agriculture in the Great War, and I tell their story in this book, are all that bunch of Bloomsburyites who went to live with Lady Ottoline Morell at Garsington. One of them, of course, was Lytton Strachey. You'll know this story, that Lytton Strachey is summoned before a tribunal for conscientious objectors, and a major in uniform says to him, tell me, Strachey, what would you do if a German soldier were trying to rape your sister? And Strachey said, I'd attempt to interpose my body between his and hers. I'm glad somebody got that joke over there. I think it was the painter Duncan Grant who was put in charge of the chickens at Garsington, and they all died fairly quickly because he forgot to feed them. But this is a story about how our society was transformed in those 5 years, how women didn't just become munitionettes and become farm labourers, but they started to do jobs that only ever men had done. They became bus conductresses, they became policewomen. And the only job that they weren't able to do on the railways because of the trade unions forbidding them was to drive the trains. They did everything else. But it was also a time when, because largely of the absence of men from our society, things changed. The greatest rate of delinquency in this country seen in the 20th century, until, of course, the 1960s, was in 1917, when there were more young offenders per head of the population than at any time until, I think, 1967 or 68. Because, as one magistrate put it, there's no father around to give the boy a clip round the ear. And so they start running riot. There's an epidemic of venereal disease that I think has never been seen before or since in the history of our country. And respectable family newspapers that had never even hinted that such a thing existed are by 1918 running full-page advertisements on how to avoid getting gonorrhea and syphilis, because large numbers of the British Army who should be out killing Germans are in hospitals in this country being treated for what we might call venereal wounds. I also tell the story at great length, I'm afraid probably too much length, of the politics of that time. This attempts to be a political, social and cultural history, and it certainly does the first two. There wasn't actually that much culture being manufactured in the Great War. All the culture we associate with the Great War, all those great books by people like Siegfried Sassoon and Robert Graves and Edmund Blunden, were all produced in the 1930s. Much of the music that commemorates the Great War was produced in the 1920s. The only really great work, two great works of music were produced in the Great War, Holst's Planets and, of course, Parry's Jerusalem. I reproduced Parry's diary entry. This was a man of astonishing modesty and great public service, who on the day that he wrote Jerusalem simply put in his diary, this was the 10th of March, 1916, his diary simply says, rain, in AM, set some words by Blake that Bridges sent me, and that's all he says about writing Jerusalem. But the political story is there, and it's largely about the decency of Asquith. In the early weeks of the war, he's so under pressure that after lunch he goes to the Athenaeum and reads a Jane Austen novel in the afternoons. Actually, I'd rather like to think of our present Prime Minister doing that in the afternoon, but he's apparently got better things to do. The country would be less damaged if he were there, I think. And then he's supplanted by Lloyd George. Now, Lloyd George is, of course, also nothing like Boris Johnson. He's an adulterer and a liar. And he very nearly loses Britain the war. He fought the 1918 coupon election on the slogan, the man who won the war. He didn't. The Royal Navy won the war by blockading Germany into starvation, and the Americans won the war by sending 2 million doughboys to Europe in July 1918 to finish the Germans off. Lloyd George had refused to send troops to Germany before the spring offensive in 1918 because he didn't want Haig to kill any more soldiers. That's quite admirable, were it not for the fact that he had allowed Haig to kill so many soldiers at Passchendaele the previous year, something he had said previously he wouldn't do. So that is roughly the book. Other people have walk-on parts in it. Winston Churchill, notably, makes the best of the Dardanelles and then makes the best of demobilisation and otherwise continues to make a mess of everything until he saves our country in 1940. I'm going to finish, because I've had my 10 minutes and I don't want to be told off by Barry or indeed by Harry, that I think the most amusing story in the book, although I will take bids for this, was of a man I discovered who was convicted of bigamy in Derby in 1917. And when his conviction appeared in the newspapers, people in Maidstone realised he was also bigamously married there. And he was hauled off to Maidstone to be tried again. And the full truth came out that he was married to 4 different women. This was very good for the women. Many women were bigamists, by the way, because they got a separation allowance from husbands who were fighting in the trenches. So you could make a career out of being married in those days. You just had to hope your husband didn't come back. But he was convicted of having 4 wives. It was also revealed he had 5 fiancées whom he was planning to marry. And to prove his commitment to pluralism, he'd also deserted from 4 regiments. Anyway, such are the fruits of my research. If you do me the honour of reading this book, I'll be very grateful. I'm afraid it's not a short trek, but it does tell you actually something quite important about where we came from. And it also tells you something quite important about why we managed to win the Second World War, because the way that we fought the first and all the mistakes we made in the first were by and large not repeated in the second. Anyway, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Simon, and apologies for my phone going off. It. Steven Spielberg, oh dear, the man's a bore begging me to work for him.